This is an Enterprise Time Security Podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Rick Grinnell from Glasswing Ventures.
Hi, Ian. Pleasure to be here with you today. Thanks for spending time with me. I could tell you a little bit about what we do at Glasswing, which is focusing on early stage AI-enabled software companies. My specialty as part of the group is to invest in interesting and revolutionary cybersecurity and now physical security as well companies. I've been investing in cybersecurity for about 20 years now. Previously worked for Fairhaven Capital, which was a Boston-based firm. 3 years ago, one of my partners there, Radina Cesari, and I decided it was time to start a new firm tightly focused around AI-enabled companies. Raised $112 million of capital to go after emerging opportunities, seed and A-round companies, typically pre-revenue when we first invest, that have the opportunity to create value for our limited partners. Mainly an East Coast focus. As a Boston-based firm, we essentially will invest anywhere but the Valley, with the feeling that there's enough quality money in the Valley that that's just not a worthy battle to be fought.
It's an incredibly busy space with startups at the moment, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Everybody who's got an idea wants money.
Exactly. And fortunately or unfortunately, however you look at it, there is more money out there than startups to put the money in.
So how do you then, when you're faced with these startups, begin to make a significantly serious business decision? Because it's easy to say, we'll take a punt or we'll take a gamble. But actually, at some point, you're going to want your money back. Other people are going to want their money back.
We are investing the pension funds and the retirement money of institutions and public and private organizations. That is our business. Everyone thinks that, oh, your job is to go find cool technology and innovate and change the world. Well, that's part of it, but it's really growing the retirement assets of the people who entrust us with their money. That being said, we as a small team, we have three partners. On average, each of us will do 2 investments per year. So in this universe, for me, of security companies, be it cyber or physical security, I have to find the best 2 or maybe the best 5, knowing that you don't win every opportunity that you try to invest in. But you've got to find 2 out of hundreds. And if you go to the show floor today, you'll see a universe. Maybe there's, I don't know what the last count is, but there's hundreds of companies out there that in many ways all sound similar. Everyone now is leveraging AI, and whether it's an endpoint company, a next generation firewall, behavioral analytics, everyone stresses the AI angle. And we started our fund at a time when most folks thought AI was a niche. In fact, we had investors as we were fundraising say, are there really enough targets out there with this AI angle as part of your investment thesis? And given what we had done back at our old firm, we thought the answer was yes. I was an investor in a company called Prelert, which was acquired by Elastic. In fact, there's still a team in London that was the core of the Prelert team. That's now the analytics layer of the Elastic engine, their SIM product in particular. Seeing that company grow in value from the investment in 2010 through the acquisition in 2016. It was the fact that they had innovative math under the hood that created the value. And my partner, Radina, was seeing that as well outside of security. And our thought was, this is the next wave. And yes, it's not big yet today, but it will be. And then fast forward to today, you go out into the show floor and AI is everywhere. And then the hard part is figuring out what's real and what's marketing.
That was exactly where I was about to go. I can remember reading books on AI back in the late 70s, early 80s. And one of the definitions of artificial intelligence at the time was its ability to make intuitive leaps, not just to be a better algorithm, but to actually look at it and define and create new sets of knowledge. If I look at virtually every AI solution that comes across me for review or for interview, what I see is some incredibly clever algorithms. I see some phenomenal machine learning, but I struggle sometimes with the use of the phrase AI, and it's almost as if without it, it's like having a sentence without a full stop. How do you pick your way through the froth, the overhype, the excitement? Because as you say, this isn't your money, it's somebody's pension fund you're investing.
That's right. And you don't want to misuse that or invest in the hype instead of the reality. In a nutshell, despite the fact that I was in the EE in computer science department at MIT 30 years ago, that was 30 years ago, I am dated when it comes to the best of breed AI technology today. And you try to stay current. Sure, you can try to keep up. But we have basically recruited over 30 world-class experts in the AI market. Now, not all of them are technologists. Some of them are more business people. But we do have about a dozen AI and computer science experts that can really walk the walk and talk the talk. And if I am meeting you and get interested in your company, I may get 80% of the way there with my knowledge and can ask you some of the right questions. But getting into some of the details, if you start getting into more PhD level topics, then I will turn to that advisory group. Typically, in one or two conversations, they're able to validate that this is actually a legitimate technology being crafted by a legitimate team, or call the bluff. More often than not, I think we're calling the bluff of folks that think they have something that's innovative, but in actuality, they really don't. They've taken some statistical algorithm that could have been done 20 years ago, have deployed it in somebody's cloud environment and think that, okay, with enough training data, I have now eliminated the need to do human set thresholding. And that's not the AI you were talking about reading in books in the past.
So when you're rejecting them and then finding that one nugget in all of it, how difficult is it to get them to give you a business case for this rather than just to make their technical case? Because at the end of the day, the people they're going to sell to, the customers who are going to buy this, they often don't care about the technicalities. There's a business issue, which is often a problematical thing with technologists.
So that raises an interesting point that I think we at Glasswing are more likely to invest in that technical team that may not have all the business answers, instead of the business team that has all of the market answers but needs to hire that technical team. Because as you can imagine, hiring in today's climate is incredibly hard. That's the easiest way to disqualify a company that's in our pipeline. There are other ways, geography filters, stage filters, but for something that you think is interesting, is in the right geography, right stage, do you have the algorithm, the AI expertise in-house? Do you have a CTO that can do this? Because typically you meet the CEO. The CEO sometimes is that technical person, but if it's not, and it's a business person, and if the answer is no, but with this round we will go hire that person, that's the easiest no. Because if you now are competing with Google and Facebook and 100 or maybe 1,000 other startups trying to find that individual who is going to walk in and be the CTO rock star, especially with a startup compensation package, particularly in the Valley is its own ecosystem, but in Boston or New York, trying to outcompensate or even come close to compensating what a large tech company can do. I mean, pick on Google, you can't win that battle. So if one of the founding team members is not that technologist, because then it's their baby, they don't care. They want to build compensation, be damned. It's the stock options. It's the glory of getting this technology out into the market. You can build a business team around that person or that technical team. The other way is much harder.
How much do you find yourself competing with universities? AI in particular is beloved of research universities because it brings a lot of commercial money into them. And many of them have built out exceptionally good ecosystems to spin out projects left, right and center. In fact, it's becoming a significant source of long-term revenue for universities around the world. Are you finding that some of the projects coming to you have spun out and maybe not achieved the next stage for the university, or they've got to a point of stability, but now they need a non-academic realism?
I think it's more the latter. One example is I have a portfolio company, Allure Security, which applies beaconing technology to documents and HTML objects. So you can track the flow of these files or web pages, web objects, as they're being used legitimately or they're being compromised or stolen. That technology was patented by a Columbia University professor who then spun the technology out. We licensed the IP, and now that professor, Salvatore Stolfo, is the CTO of the company. Now he's still professor on sabbatical. That's a case where millions of dollars of money went into it, funneled through the university from DARPA and DHS and other places, built that portfolio of IP that once ready for prime time, you could commercialize and build a product around with use cases involving trying to track down insider trading. So putting beacons in financial documents for companies that may have created their quarterly financials but haven't released those financials to the street yet. And there's that window of opportunity to hijack that data and trade on it. There's obviously intellectual property theft that can be tracked with that technology. And then more recently, they've worked on embedding the beacons into websites so that you can actually determine when those sites have been scraped by adversaries who are trying to use those objects for cloning to create phishing attacks. That so far has been successful, taking that Columbia IP. You know, we haven't had an exit yet. It's still somewhat early days, but that's worked. I have on other occasions, not in the current portfolio, but in the old portfolio at my old firm, and not necessarily in cybersecurity, because I don't find that many cybersecurity companies spinning out of the university labs. I tend to see, if I think about our old firm, industrial technologies, materials, things that are more high science or deep science, where they would spin out, the professor would become the CTO or the CEO. But then the problem there sometimes is that these things do become the long-term science projects and the professors aren't necessarily the best people to run the business. But at the same time, when the market is more deeply technical, like some esoteric material, for example, you want the point person to the outside world to be maybe that professor because of that technical knowledge. Security is a little bit different. I don't see the universities as competition. And even on talent, I think if someone decides I'd rather take a position at MIT in the computer science department versus becoming the CTO of one of your companies, just that decision means that that person probably wasn't entrepreneurial enough. It's a lifestyle decision that I would rather go down an academic path because working in a startup is very different than working in a university lab. I think they're equally admirable, but someone starting a company has a very different mindset.
When you're looking at the companies, a couple of things come to mind here. The first is, how much weight do you put behind their IP portfolio as something you can fall back on? So if the company crashes, you've got something perhaps to recover. And secondly, how many of them have a wide enough idea to sustain a business growth rather than be a point solution or a feature solution?
IP is important. Patent portfolio, I mean, to be honest, most of the things we invest in at an early stage don't have a granted patent yet. They may have filed, so you're taking the risk that that pending patent will become truly patented at some point in time. And you're right, it is for the downside case that there's some asset value left at the end, residual value left at the end of the day. I'd say, again, it's more on the mid case where a company is valuable, but maybe not CrowdStrike. Trading at $18 billion today, the last I checked. I'm not sure how much the street is valuing their IP portfolio as much as the hype and the customer traction and the growth. So I think for a company that's knocking it out of the park, everyone looks at the top line and the growth rates. It's when you're stuck in the middle and you're getting acquired, it's that patent portfolio that I think offers some cushion and leverage on what that minimum valuation can be. It is important. I rarely see startups use their patent portfolios to then go prosecute and say, hey, wait, you know, company X, that's 20 times my size, you're infringing. Because it's hard to go fight those when you're a small company. You barely have enough resources to hire salespeople, let alone go pay attorneys to go chase down infringement. On the second part of your question, IP portfolio is important. Still, the most important thing is having the technical people in place at the beginning and then having the knowledge that if the business team isn't there yet, you can bring those people in. Like I mentioned, what happened with NormShield before we went on live, so to speak, where they had a great core technical team, founding team, but with the financing, we brought in 3 sales, marketing, and business development executives to supplement the technologists. And that's worked out really well. But people still are the ones that drive the value of the companies. IP is important, but it's the people, the engineers who develop the product, the salespeople, the marketing people that then drive top line, that really, at the end of the day, are the true value of the company. And then if they drive sales, then some acquirer or the public markets will absorb that company at a multiple of that revenue, usually not a multiple of earnings out of the gate. like again with CrowdStrike, where there's no earnings yet, but they're trading at what now, 70 times revenue, which is unbelievable. So to then the point around point products versus full solutions, most startups, to be blunt, are point products or their features. And they're from the beginning set up that way. And VCs, in many cases, still fund them, not in all cases, because there's always this saying, do we fund features, products, or companies? And the big, most successful name brand VCs would say, we only fund companies. We would never fund a feature. That's not what we do. But sometimes features and products can create a lot of value without ever getting to the true company stage. Now, you have to fund them appropriately. You can't fund a feature company with 100 million of capital and hope that you're going to make 10 times that on the other side. If you look at what the markets typically bear for acquisition, on a good day, you should plan on $100 to $200 million outcome for a company that falls into that feature to product bucket. As you graduate from product to company, you might then cross the $1 billion mark, and that's where the Cylances exiting to BlackBerry, Carbon Black going public, they've hit that kind of $1.5 billion number. And then with appropriate vision to become a full-blown soup-to-nuts solution provider, which is, I think, what CrowdStrike has been effectively able to do, they have positioned themselves as the leading high-growth cloud-enabled or cloud-delivered endpoint protection product. And they have told the best story, and the combination of great product, great tech, great story has made them the company and affords them, at least at this point in time, a valuation that's 50% higher than Symantec.
What pressure does that put on you? As you say, part of this is really spotting the right people in the right locations. You've got companies out there who have some really good ideas. Some may productize easily. Some may take a longer time. Some may not actually have any breadth to them. They go to the core of a problem, but that's about it. So does that put pressure on you to say, well, there's a point here where to protect investment or to grow these, rather than end up with two or three or four investments that might make 30, 40 million, put them together, here's a $500 million company that actually is likely to be a very easy acquisition target for somebody else. Does that happen?
Does, but where that typically happens is at the next level up from where we sit. So Glasswing is in the venture capital business. If you go up a rung of the ladder, you're in that growth stage private equity world. And I see those firms in particular having that strategy where let's take two or three or five assets that are all doing $30, $40, $50 million in revenue, not big enough individually to go public and not maybe interesting enough on their own to get acquired by Cisco or Palo Alto, but packaged up and with a little bit of strategic refinement and maybe augmenting the CEO role or some other executive position in the company, we could create an entity that could go into the public markets in a year or two. And I think you see folks like Insight and Tomo Bravo in particular, who have been very good at taking disparate assets and creating these quote unquote super companies that then they can turn around and market to the public markets within some number of quarters. It's a strategy that works at that level and not at ours in particular, because I think about out of the portfolio that I have, every one of those companies has a slightly different syndicate composition. Now, if every deal that I did had the same co-investor, then that strategy could work. But now you've got, let's just pick a portfolio of 10 companies. Across those 10 companies, I have 10 different co-investors, and maybe some of them have then raised follow-on capital. So it's not just another Series A co-lead, but it's also a Series B lead. So let's say there's three unique investors, or two unique in addition to us. So now there's 20 investors. If you were trying to create the super company out of those 10, and I'm exaggerating the point by saying I now have 20, but that would be like herding cats to get each one of them had stars in their eyes at the beginning of their investment thinking I own 20% of this individual company or 15% or whatever the threshold was. If I create this super company, I'm going to be diluted to the point where now I own 2% or maybe 3% along with this high volume number of co-investors. So you could argue that, hey, 2 to 3% of a $10 billion company is more valuable, but it's hard to pull off.
it's interesting when you watch things like Shark Tank and Dragons Den, you see exactly these same decisions being made, and you watch how quickly people crumble and they're crushed without actually realizing that the reality is that if you stay on your own, your growth is very slow and limited. You take this route, your growth could be so much more. At the end of the day, 5% of a very large pie is much better than 100% of a biscuit.
But thinking about how firms typically want to maintain control, and as you know, how control provisions work, it's a percentage of the preferred that's required to do this, that, and the other. When you're now talking about a larger number of investors, each with a smaller sliver, then no one has the control they used to have. Probably all but two out of the syndicate have lost their board seat. Making money in our business is very important, but there's a credit and control aspect that, I hate to say it, is part of the ego of venture capital, that yes, that was a successful exit, and oh, by the way, I was on the board when it went public, or I get credit because I took it from this point to that point. And I just think creating these super companies where 90% of the VCs or 80% of the VCs are now not in control, they're just kind of passively along for the ride, is hard to pull off. And that's why you see these private equity buyouts where, hey, we'll clean up the entire thing. It'll just be one or two. It's going to be Thoma Bravo or Bain or someone. And then as far as a venture person, I've already then, quote unquote, exited. It's now their company. I'm happy with where I got out, and now they have to take it to the next level. And sometimes that's embarrassing, though. I can think of cases where the VC sold out for X, and the private equity guys within a year or two doubled or tripled X. If the VCs had been willing to do what you just talked about, which was merge it with something else and not allow the ego and the control to come into the equation.
So somebody's got an idea. They come to you. What should they do? And what are the things not to do when having a conversation with you?
Number one, don't tell me you're going to hire the technologist, that with the funding, you will hire that. So that immediate disqualification. I think just like we talked about, again, before we went live, doing homework on who you're talking to, knowing a little bit about the firm and also the partner, understanding who I am. I love it when someone walks in the door and says, hey, I listened to your podcast that you did, and I'll talk about music because music is what got me into technology back in the day. And they'll say, hey, I also got into tech because I was into music electronics. I loved building guitar amps when I was a kid or something like that. Resonates. And having that connection helps. Now, obviously, I'm not going to fund someone just because they built guitar amps when they were a kid, but it does make me think a little bit more highly than someone who comes in cold and says, oh, tell me about your background. How long have you been in venture? If they don't know the history and some of the exits I've had along the way, to me, boy, how are you going to sell to your customer base? Because you have to do that same homework on them. You need to understand if you're selling to the CISO of Walmart or Target or Bank of America, you got to connect. It's knowing that the sales process you use on me and other venture capitalists is how we are going to assume you're going to sell to your future customer base. And if you're not good at selling us, then that's strike one, two, and three for the opportunity. So doing homework.
Given the number of companies seeking your money, I wish you good luck in finding those nuggets.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for talking to us.
Yes, you bet. Thanks for having me.